So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardawar.
And Reviews Editor Sherlyn Liu.
Today, it's all about Mars once again. We're going to be chatting about the Mars Perseverance rover. It just landed on the Red Planet this week, and we brought on a very cool guest, Sophia Gadd-Nasser, to chat about this landing, what it means, why it's so special, and what is going to be going on with this mission in the future. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes, and you can always email us at podcast@engadget.com. So let's talk about the Mars Perseverance rover, which just landed this week. And to chat about that, we brought on a tremendous guest, somebody whose videos I've been watching for a while now on TikTok and all over. We have PhD candidate Sophia Gadd-Nasser. How are you doing, Sophia?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thank you. And, you know, let's just say up front, who are you? What do you do? I think you're a very good presenter of scientific information, but how do you approach your, what are you working on the internet these days?
Oh, so on the internet, I do a lot of science communication and anywhere spaces. I'm pretty much there just because I love this stuff so much. But in my work, I work on like the really sort of spooky side of the universe. I work on dark matter.
Okay. All right. Nice. And I know you've been a scientific, you've been a science advisor to some shows, right? Like 12 Monkeys?
Yes, I have.
So yeah, your work is out there. So my first question for you is, what can you tell us what is so important about the Mars Perseverance rover and this mission overall, because we just had the Curiosity rover landed almost a decade ago now. What is special about this, and how is it different from Curiosity?
Yeah, so this is an important question, I think, and it's a question that a lot of people have, because we have just, as you said, landed not too long ago another rover on Mars. And every rover landing that we have is a huge feat, mind you, because it's really hard to do this stuff. But with Perseverance, I call it like a mission of the future, because it has experiments on it that are preparing Mars for humans to come. So it's preparing for astronauts to land on the planet. And so that's why I call it a mission of the future. And that's why it's so important. And it's also going to look for signs of past life on Mars as well. So it's a really, really big mission. It'll be holding onto soil for like a future mission to come and pick up. It's all like, it's very much tied into like future missions and the future of space exploration.
For sure. You brought up some cool things. I believe you did like a great TikTok just like highlighting some of the great elements of this mission. Can you expand that on that a little? Like it's going to be involved in oxygen production, sort of, right? For the future?
Yeah. So it has a whole bunch of different like experiments on it, but one is called MOXIE. And that's it's like the Mars Oxygen ISRU experiment. but it's an experiment that's going to be on Mars, taking the carbon dioxide in the air and converting it into oxygen. And what this experiment is essentially doing is seeing how, or whether it's feasible to do this, so that in the future, if it works out, then they would actually send something more, I guess a larger scale thing that would prepare for humans.
Gotcha. Yeah, it is a very forward-facing mission, it seems, too. And you mentioned like it's going to be collecting samples. How is that different from Curiosity? Because I know like Curiosity also sampled some soil and sent that information back too. But I guess this one is going to be holding onto it. How is that special, I guess, and how will that help future astronauts?
Well, it's going to help. It's not necessarily just future astronauts, but like just for us, we're actually going to get like our first samples of Mars, like directly from the planet. And so the difference between this mission and the other one is that this is actually holding on to these samples and waiting for a future mission to come and pick them up, bring them back to Earth.
Yeah. And that's going to be a much bigger job right now, right? I feel like every rover launch right now, we've had a couple, satellites from other countries kind of make their way to Mars orbit. Just doing that is difficult enough, but the future missions you're talking about would also have to land and lift off from the planet and come back. How far away are we from a mission like that? Like 10 years, 15 years?
Well, just for the mission that would bring back the samples alone, that we're waiting, we're looking at earliest 2031, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so to see, it's at least 10 years minimum.
Wow. Okay. But I think one thing I really want to dive into here too is the landing process of the Perseverance rover. And I think it's worth doing. NASA released a 3.5 minute video of the entire landing sequence, starting from space, starting with the heat shield going down. Let's take a look at that. And why don't we talk over it a little, like a game stream. If you see anything notable, if there's anything you want our audience to know, because we're seeing the parachute deploy right now in our video stream. Talk us through this a little, please.
Okay, so we've passed one of the most, I guess, the scariest parts, which is atmospheric entry, because during atmospheric entry, you get like huge heating. And of course, Perseverance is encased in sort of like a protection shield. It has a heat shield that will protect it from that. But there's also like, at this point, we're at a parachute deployment, and this is a supersonic parachute, so it has to deploy faster than the speed of sound. Okay. So let's have to bring that up because that's really
pretty
cool.
Wild. I also love the shot of the heat shield falling into Mars. Just seems like it is breathtaking to me. It reminds me of like the shot that you see whenever a rocket lifts off from Earth and you see like the booster kind of fall back a little into Earth. Like it is exactly that, except it's completely different too, right?
Yes, exactly. And so like, so it drops off the heat shield so that it, so that it can has less weight, and then it kind of can more guide itself. And then at this point, it starts turning on things like it has a radar on it, where that radar is going to help it sort of figure out where it is at that point so that it can land. But then this new technology kicks in. It's called the Terrain Relative Navigation. And so this technology, essentially what it's going to do is scan the land that is around it, and then take that, match it to a map that it has on board so it can figure out where it is. And then that way it kind of sees where it's going. And very so cool. I think at this point, I don't know. Okay. So we're still kind of hanging on and waiting, because eventually there's going to be
we see the gusts of air too, right? That it looks like the rover is blasting out to kind of just
well, that's the thing itself. Above it, right? The mechanism that's actually helping to slow it down, because I believe there isn't enough air drag for the parachute to do enough to slow it down, right?
Exactly. And so it has to turn on its little rockets that are on this sort of a back shell thing that it has. And so these little rockets are what it has to use to guide it. And then once the back shell is sort of gone, it has this it'll have these, it's on the descent stage, sorry. Mm-hmm. So on the descent stage, it has 8 rockets. And that's what we're seeing kind of like, causing the soil to go all, And so that's what it has to use in order to have a safe landing, because as you said, there's no drag. And the parachute obviously wasn't going to help in the atmosphere. The atmosphere is only 1% of Earth's. And so, so this is like, and there's the sky crane. So the sky crane, basically, that's everything. It's done. Like, so the Sky Crane has done its job. Its job is literally to get Mars down, or to get Perseverance down to Mars safely. And then it just flies off. Okay. And I think the Sky Crane this time landed like 700 meters away from Perseverance and crashed.
That's amazing. There is some fan fiction to be written about that poor Sky Crane. It's like, I did my job. Time to die. Time to just go sit in Mars. Maybe somebody will rescue me eventually.
Where are the memes?
exactly. Did the Curiosity rover, did it have a similar landing setup? Because I feel like this is a little different almost, right?
Yeah, it is. And it has also new technology and stuff like that. And it's really similar. The landings for Curiosity and Perseverance are very similar.
Gotcha. One thing we noticed too, there was like a bit of a puzzle that NASA kind of hinted at as the parachute was deploying, and people on the internet immediately got to it, and they noticed like there are all these markings around the parachute. The nerds immediately saw, I was like, this is binary code. And it only took a couple hours for someone to decode it. And apparently it says Dare Mighty Things in the concentric circles, and also has the location of the NASA, one of the NASA visitor centers, I believe, right? And what is the significance of this, Sophia? Because I know it's a phrase we come back to quite a bit with every NASA mission, right? It's at the heart of the organization.
Yeah, so Dare Mighty Things, it's NASA's motto. And so I know NASA loves to send these like Easter eggs with missions, and this was one of them. There's more to come, mind you. So there are more to come. We haven't seen them all yet. And so keep your eyes open for that. I know people will be sitting there waiting to try to decode them. If it's a code, for example, or if it's something like this, where we didn't understand what it was, we had to like decode it and stuff. I thought it was great. Like, it was what, 6 hours later, somebody came up with the solution. It was just like that. Dare Mighty Things. It's the motto of NASA. And then they had like the coordinates on it too. And Dare Mighty Things is so fitting because every mission that they send out into space is mighty. It's like they are daring the mightiest of things.
It's an immediate rebuke to everybody who's like, why are we spending money on Mars? It's like we have enough problems on Earth. And it just seems like so this motto, CNN points out, it borrows from the Theodore Roosevelt quote, "Far better is it to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy nor suffer much because they live in a gray twilight that knows not victory nor defeat." Damn, that's a bit of a slam, I think, to the negative naysayers, but it really strikes to the heart of what NASA tries to do, right? Just trying to make us think of a better, bigger future with these missions.
Yes, and I mean, I think a lot of people that say things like you know, that we're wasting money on space missions probably don't really know how much money space exploration gets in the first place. Okay, because in 2020, it got 0.48% of the entire government's budget. So we got less than 0.5% of it. Mm-hmm. Not much. Definitely not the thing that you want to go and attack. But another thing I think people don't realize is that just because we're sending something, it's because we're sending something out so far, they don't see how the benefits can be tangible to us.
Right.
It's just so removed from us. But space exploration and bettering our space flight, our equipment and all that stuff, bettering that stuff has actually brought us so many practical advances. Like, you use these practical advances every day. If you're a TikToker, for example, or you're happy to, you know, happily can connect with people using like your video, your phone camera. I think one third of everybody's phone cameras are still the ones that came from space flight. And so medical advances, like, you know, there's the CAT scans. These are things that also came from space exploration. It's so much more, you know, I mean, it's almost kind of like if I lived in like a building, okay, where that's kind of like where I was stuck my entire life. And I knew I could go out, but I didn't know what was out there. Mm-hmm. I think people would end up trying to go out and see, like, hang on a second, I do want to know what we're in, right? Because it's like this huge thing. And now we do know that we're in this giant universe that's like mind-blowingly vast, like so bigger than we can ever imagine. And so we're just trying to study the little side of it that we're in so that we can figure out more about our planet. If we know how planets evolve in general, if we know how life can form on other planets, if we know more about like how they form, that can tell us a lot about our own planet. So these are actually things that will give us tangible results or tangible things that we can actually use practically in our life and we do every day.
Gotcha. Can we talk about specifics of this mission too? Because I know a lot of it is devoted to finding signs of ancient life on Mars. And there was a great editorial in the New York Times recently too about like why Mars and is actually a good place to do this because it is so frigid and so cold and things can be preserved. But yeah, can you talk a bit about that mission and what NASA is trying to learn from all this?
Yeah, so Like, for example, Mars is one of the planets that are kind of in a habitable zone. The other one is Venus, which is scorching hot. And so the last time I think Russia tried to drop a probe into Venus, it just got crushed. Like, so, and, you know, it just melted away and got crushed because there's huge pressure and intense heat over there. And so, because it's like it's a sort of runaway greenhouse effect that keeps going on. And so that's not a good place to look. So Mars is, it has temperatures that are good for spacecraft or like rovers that we send and such. It has some atmosphere. It's 1% of Earth's, but it still has some atmosphere. And we found things like, you know, like the way that the land is sort of worn away is like, that can only be done by water. Yeah. And so we found that this is like every, you know, a lot of things hint towards the possibility of there having been life. And so in this mission, they want to actually find that. So they're going to be looking like through minerals and different things like that to see if there are any, or to find any ancient signs of life that they can. And so, that makes this mission. And then of course the Martian soil that they're going to bring back over here for us to study. There's just so many cool things in this mission.
Cool. Is there anything specific about the location where they landed? Cause it is a basin, right? So it's some place where they believe there was a lot of water at one point. And if there's a lot of water, there is probably a lot of life forming them. Early life, maybe something even, you know, more complex than we expect. But is that, can you tell us about the location of where it landed to?
Yeah. So it landed on Jezero Crater. Which is the site that it's going to use to study and to like pick up its samples and such. And yeah, because it does look like there might have been water there, and so that was a good site to land at for them to do all this.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah, it's so exciting. And also because we're in Gadget, we cannot help but look at the tech specs of this rover. And NASA actually put out like a major, almost like a product page for this thing, right? Where they describe the rover brains. It's a processor that has, it's a radiation hardened central processor with power PC 750 architecture, a BAE RAD 750. By the way, shouting out power PC 750, that is the same hardware that was at the heart of the G3 Max from the early 2000s. So kind of funny to see, you know, that earlier tech show up in space. It operates at a speed up to 200 megahertz, 10 times faster than the Spirit and Opportunity computers. It has 2 gigabytes of flash memory, 256 megabytes of dynamic random access memory, and 256 kilobytes of electrically erasable programmable read-only memory. So it feels like a very low-spec computer, but I guess that is what we can safely send to Mars, right? That will actually survive the radiation and the cold and everything, right?
Exactly. And so, I mean, you can either be impressed or disappointed. I think impressed by a mission like that being run by like essentially a Pentium 1, which is from 1992. Or impressed, or disappointed because you would think that, you know, it has more. But the thing is, the thing that they know about this processor is that it's reliable. It will protect this stuff from the intense radiation that it's going to have to deal with. And okay, I think like over several hundred missions in space are using this processor, and so it's reliable, and it uses very little power. Yes, we're limited with power, so I know that Perseverance is carrying with it some, I think, like 11 pounds of plutonium. And so plutonium has, it kind of naturally undergoes radioactive decay, which releases heat. And that heat, it converts to electricity. But remember, I said 11 pounds. That means it's limited. And so eventually it's going to deplete. Uh-huh. So we don't want to have, you know, processes eating up too much power so that, you know, we want to extend the mission as long as possible. And so, you know, you look at that and, you know, you might be disappointed, but if then compare it to like the Voyagers, which were launched in like what, 1970s, the Voyagers were, they had what, I think almost set, like less, like about 70 kilobytes of memory.
Crazy.
And half a megabyte of storage. Half a megabyte of storage. All I think all my pictures are bigger than that, and so uh-huh. you know. So it's like it's still in terms of space flight, it's not so updated from past missions, but it's reliable and it's it works. Mm-hmm.
We've come a long way, certainly, on the tech side. The NASA describes the rover's body as the Warm Electronics Box, or WEB for short. Like a car body, they say it's a strong outer layer that protects the rover's computer and electronics. I'd say go look at some photos of this stuff on NASA's site, because the rover itself looks like a WALL-E. It looks like WALL-E from the Pixar movie, who's kind of spread out with wheels, and it's just kind of like janky and put together, but... It is not, it's not a polished thing. And you look at a lot of space work, it doesn't look like consumer polish, but it's made to withstand everything, right? This is a tough, tough machine.
Yeah. It's made to withstand a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, like the primary thing that you're going to deal with in space is cosmic radiation and radiation in space. And so everything that's on this rover has to be able to withstand that, and so it's encased in a protective shield. The processor comes with this, like as you said, radio, like it's like a radiation hardened, and so it just protects from that, and because we need that, like that's the biggest, that's one of the biggest problems as well in terms of like space in human space flight to Mars, is that we need to figure out how to protect things from radiation. Well,
yes. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So now that it's on the planet, it does seem like NASA is slowly getting more information. I guess it certainly takes a while for data and observational stuff to make it back to Earth. But they did release on the second day the sound of Mars. And it is a very eerie thing. Let's just close your eyes, everybody. Take a minute and listen to this, because I think it is it's just a fascinating thing to hear. Let's roll that audio.
I invite you now to, if you would like to, close your eyes and just imagine yourself sitting on the surface of Mars and listening to the surroundings. If I could have the first one, please. So that gentle whirl that happens in the background, that is a noise made by the rover. But yes, what you did hear 10 seconds in was an actual wind gust on the surface of Mars, picked up by the microphone, sent back to us here on Earth. The analysis indicates that was around a 5 meter per second type of wind gust. So we have actually, we can sit here now and actually tell you that we have recorded sound from the surface of Mars. So we have a second one, basically further reduced the noise of the rover. So you can just hear what the wind would sound like on Mars. And once again, I invite you to sit back and have a listen to what it would sound like to be on Mars.
There it is.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
It is a weird noise, because it's almost what I've been to, like some areas that aren't quite deserts, but like if you go out in the middle of nowhere and like in Nevada or something, like you can start to just hear wind. There's no trees rustling. There's like not much else except for like that gentle wind. And yeah, you just kind of feel it. It may not sound like much at first. How did you feel hearing that, Sophia?
Oh, to be frank, I lost it. I was like, oh my goodness, we got sound on Mars. And this is like, you know, this is real sound. Like if you are on social media, you probably saw this tweet that went viral with a mm-hmm. video, you know, claiming that was sound on Mars. That was actually, I think, Curiosity. Mm-hmm. None of the missions that are on Mars now have a microphone except for Perseverance. And so that's not, that definitely wasn't it. It wasn't Perseverance and it was not the sound on Mars. So getting this was just incredible. It's like the first time that we can hear sound on another planet, which is so huge mm-hmm. because, you know, we know that in space, you can't hear anything. Okay. In space, because sound needs a medium to propagate in. And in space, you don't have one. It's essentially close. It's as close you can get to a vacuum. Whereas on Mars, we do have a little bit of atmosphere. And so you will be able to hear stuff. And that's it. Like we got to hear sound on another planet. So it made me feel wonderful. I don't know. It made me feel like it was kind of like the reality of opening like doors to the future of space exploration. And so this is just, this mission is just all about that to me. And so I'm just really, really excited about it.
Awesome. Well, I know you have to go soon. I'm just wondering, last question for you. What are you looking forward to, you know, from this mission? What sort of data, what sort of more insights are you really excited to see soon from NASA? Because I'm sure there's a lot of stuff to you that is like 10 years out, right?
The helicopter. I want to see if it flies. I want to see it. Yeah, so I think it's charging right now. Yep. I think it's going to be charging for about 30 to 60 days, depending on what. I think it was like 30 to 60. Yeah, so it's sitting there and charging. It's getting recharged by Perseverance. And then the flight starts. And so I'm really excited for that. Keep your eyes out for that. It's going to be the first time that we have a helicopter on another planet flying, hopefully.
Fingers crossed, everything crossed, toes crossed and all too. Thank you so much, Sophia, for joining us and explaining all this for us. Where can people find your work on the internet and follow you and everything?
I'm Astro Particle everywhere. So it's like Astro Particle, but instead of the C-L-E, it's girl. So uh-huh. Astro Particle, Twitter, TikTok, yep. Now, Instagram, Facebook. And I do have a website as well. So you can actually use it to like mostly contact me. It's not super updated, but I will be updating that as well. But my social media, I'm all over it. So
sure, for sure. I first read that as Astro Party Girl, and I saw on your website that you definitely, you clarify that, but I think either way works, right? Astro Party
Girl. I love space parties. I'm totally happy with that. Space parties. It's just, yeah. It's just that, yeah, I'm okay with either. It's just, I like people to know where yeah. it comes from, because it's like the astroparticle part. But yeah, I'm totally happy with space parties. I would jam at one note and no problem.
So. Awesome. Thank you so much. I hope to chat again with you on the Engadget podcast.
Thank you.
I'm done with Mars. Let's talk about some other tech. Sherlyn, I know you've got a ton of Android news. What is up with Google stuff?
Hells yeah. So Android 12 isn't going to be ready for a while. We just saw the first developer preview recently, maybe last week. And that doesn't mean, though, that we don't have any new features to look mm-hmm. forward to. Google's actually been changing up its update cadence, I feel like, in the last few years or so, where it actually just releases like sets of updates as they're ready. It doesn't like wait till a major release anymore to
That's
share.
That's good.
Them.
I prefer this, honestly. I like, yeah. like a few features here and there. Yeah.
Yeah, it might make like each new version of Android feel like it's less of a huge update, but you do get these features sooner instead of having to wait around for an arbitrary date. So with this set of updates, there's like half a dozen new things. And I think the biggest thing that most of us were excited for is scheduled texts. Scheduled texts meaning in the Messages app. So only in, you know, text, RCS text or text. You can set a message to send like at whatever time you want. So the practical uses for this are like if you're texting with someone in a different time zone and you don't want to wake them up, so you set a message to send only when, you know, they're awake. So like if you're, I don't know, you want to send a good morning message, but you're afraid you're not going to be up yet.
Or if you have random thought in the middle of the night and you don't want to bug your friends. Sure, Lynn.
That's what Twitter is for. But yeah. Yeah, I also do send a lot of late night text messages. This is very true. All the group chats are of me going like, why are trefoils called trefoils or something? I don't know. But yeah,
magnets, how do they work? Yeah.
Schedule text is awesome. And it's one thing I don't think iOS people have yet. So
no, way to rub it in.
Baby. I know. But we have, y'all have other things that we don't have. Like a good messaging app. Anyway, in addition to scheduled text, there are a bunch of other things, right? There's a new dark mode for Google Maps. That one's been rumored for a long time, for a few months now. So now if you're driving around in the dark, you can use dark mode on Google Maps and it won't have to scorch your eyes anymore. There is assistant can now be used on when your phone is locked. Now that obviously presents some privacy related issues and concerns, but it's a setting that you can enable. So if you prefer the convenience of being able to use Assistant even when your phone is locked and when it's far away, it's actually helpful for people who really want to use Assistant hands-free all the time,
sure,
but don't have a speaker, for example. This is a trade-off you might have to make, or you just have to be very careful about your privacy. And then speaking of hands-free use, there's also improvements made to the TalkBack screen reader. Google's revamped it to make it a little less clutter. They've simplified some of the navigation, integrated some of it, so the menus used to be very confusing. And then they also added new gestures, multi-finger gestures, to get the screen reader to read you articles. So if you swipe left or right with three fingers, you can change the reading options for articles from reading headlines only, to reading every word, to reading even every single character. So just keep swiping to toggle through those. So, you know, I talk a bit about accessibility in my coverage, and this is one of the things that Google is doing, and I think it's a good thing that they're working on it. Yeah, that they continue to update it. And then the last few updates, generally less important to me, Android Auto. I don't drive because I'm in the New York area. So, you know, but there's some updates. You get a new, you can play now voice activated games, Devendra. So the next time you're in your fancy new car and you maybe have Android Auto, I know you're an iPhone person, but you could start a trivia game or Jeopardy.
That seems like a bad idea, but okay.
if you're on a road trip or something.
Yeah, that's fun.
Or you have to entertain the kids or something. And then there's some other features like custom wallpapers for your dashboard, split screen if you have a wider screen, and a privacy screen when you have like to decide when you show your Android Auto screen, if you have someone in the car with you or not. Mm-hmm. So just a bunch of updates. I think it's nice. People who are on Android may appreciate it. And a lot of these, it's not clear yet just how immediate they will go into effect. But they're expected in the coming weeks or so. So look at your phone. Keep updating.
Very cool. Very cool. Well,
yeah.
I think there's other news happening too. Sony gave us a brief glimpse of what's going to be coming with the next PlayStation VR that's going to work with the PlayStation 5. It's not coming this year, but they dropped a blog post that was just like, hey, we like VR. We have a new one coming. Okay. It'll be better. It'll look clearer. It's all like very vague. I expect a higher resolution, a wider field of view. Those are all things they kind of referenced. Better tracking. And they even talked about like having a new VR controller, which is kind of interesting because right now Sony relies on the old Move controllers, which are very old. The Move controllers and its old Move camera with the PlayStation 4, you know, those things were around for a while. And I was shocked when I reviewed the PSVR in like 2016 that, you know, it delivered a pretty decent VR experience. But yeah, they need a new controller. So if they
I have thoughts on this because I'm just now looking at the picture of, I believe, is the PSVR set with the two controllers with
the
orbs on the end of the... Jeez, that's not very sophisticated. That looks a lot like Lenovo's... Oy, I played a Marvel AR MR game with Lenovo's Mirage 2 years ago.
It's very similar, the
same style. Yeah, and it's no, you can do better than that.
I mean, those Move controllers came out really early in the 2010s too. I believe even, weren't they part of the PlayStation 3? I gotta look at the history there. But that's old hardware that they kind of retrofitted to be VR stuff. So I was shocked it worked, and it worked pretty well. The problem was the setup for PlayStation VR is a mess, right? Because you need to have the camera, you need to have a giant cable trailing through your living room to the headset. There's like a breakout cable in the headset. You got to plug in headphones into that cable, I believe. So like, it's a whole bunch of things all at once. So I hope this next version is more streamlined. It's probably still going to be cabled, but give me like a single cable, built-in headphones with the option of using my own or something. And, you know, better quality and stuff would be nice. But certainly the PlayStation 5 is fast enough to do much, much better VR than the PlayStation 4. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's
I have a few questions about this as a budding console gamer.
You keep saying that, but what evidence is there other than your
Switch? Budding.
Budding.
Here's my question. One, what are the VR game titles like on PS versus Xbox? And two, what's the Xbox VR situation?
Yeah, I was going to get to that. There, I mean, we still have anything for Xbox, right? Microsoft, I think, has said that the Xbox Series X could run VR. It certainly has the hardware for it, but they have not announced anything. They never did. They didn't touch VR with the Xbox One series of consoles. It was all like Windows VR. And it even seems like Microsoft is taking a step back from that now. So I don't know. I was kind of predicting like maybe they're waiting for wireless VR to become more of a thing. But that would be super expensive. That would be, you know, a $500 headset, even just to get the wireless receiver and everything. So we don't know. The Xbox Series X does have has a USB port up front. For VR, you'd also need an HDMI jack, so like it's a whole bunch of things. Microsoft has no strategy, whereas Sony did a pretty good job of launching the PSVR with a bunch of really cool games. Some of the early experiences, like there was a Batman one that was super cool. Since then, games like Resident Evil 7 was updated to support VR. So you could play that entire game in first person in VR on a pretty old console. So that was all really impressive to me. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite games, by the way, Resident Evil, but except for I used to play it in an actual arcade with the actual gun toy things.
So. I think you're thinking of a different game. Are you thinking of House of the
Dead? Maybe House of the Dead.
Yeah, you're thinking of House of the Dead. Different house
well, in I
Evil.
Did also, yeah, exactly. I also did play Resident Evil somewhere, somehow. I feel like that's very
Somewhere,
familiar.
Somehow.
Maybe I'll watch the movies. Anyhow.
Or you could be thinking of Time Crisis. But yeah, that would be House of the Dead if it was...
Oh, I loved Time Crisis.
Yeah.
Oh,
you had arcades. You were lucky.
The stepper thing. I loved my arcades. I had a childhood. This is true.
You had a childhood with arcades. I miss social things. So hopefully we will get back to a place where we could do things and play games in public too. What else is up with you, Sherlyn? Because I know you've got a lot of cool news you're sitting on.
I know. So in hardware, in the world of hardware, I think this is a big piece of news. Huawei unveiled its Mate X2 foldable phone. And this is like, it's been a while since we saw Huawei do its foldable phone. We saw a Mate XS, I believe, last year, I want to say, which was more durable than the original Mate X. Now, as a refresher, when the foldable phone war started happening, Samsung came out with the Galaxy Fold. It folded inwards upon itself. And that iteration has sort of been the same. That format has sort of been the same for Samsung. Meanwhile, Huawei came out and was like, no, we think folding outwards is going to work. Like have the screen bend and face outwards. That was the original Mate X or Mate 10 or however they want to pronounce
it. Was that ever released? We kept talking about it.
It was never really sold large scale. We saw it floating around at conventions or whatever. And if it ever went on sale, it was very limited run. and I don't actually believe it ever did. We had pricing information announced for it, but I don't know how many people actually were able to buy it. Anyhow, that was how the Mate foldables were right? They folded, bent outwards. The Mate X2 that was announced this week, looks a lot more like the Galaxy Fold.
Maybe they realized it's a pretty bad idea to have just all screen out.
Yeah, I feel like Huawei probably took a while to figure out how to make it more durable, and then we're like, oh crap, this is probably not going to work because screens are very fragile. So what happened is now, basically, there's a 8-inch inner screen that folds upon itself, and then an outer screen that's 6.5 inches with a slightly different aspect ratio than the Galaxy Fold.
Sure.
Both of these screens are OLEDs, and they have 90 hertz refresh rates, which good. These are good specs.
Wild. Yeah.
Especially for a flexible screen on the inside. But because it's Huawei, a few things to note. One. No Google apps, right? There's not a proper Google app store in there. You won't have access to your Gmail, G Drive, etc. unless you find a way to sideload. Lots of questions there about that. The phone will run EMUI 11. EMUI is Huawei's sort of Android open source based software. And it's based on Android 10. So this is basically Huawei taking AOSP. Which is an open source code and platform anyway that basically anyone can take and tweak to their heart's desire. And not official Android, right? Which is currently on 11 and the developer preview for 12 was just released. So that's supposed to come through soon. We're not sure. Now, okay, before I explain to you guys some other things about Huawei that we want to be careful about, yep, let's just quickly talk about what this device looks like, right? It looks really thin. It looks very nice. And having played with the original Huawei Mate foldable phone, I feel like Huawei's hardware is going to be very good. Huawei has made some really good-looking phones in the past.
We like their laptops too, right? So
we love their laptops. Mm-hmm. Their laptops, well, a lot very, very MacBook clone-ish, but solid, sturdy, good-looking. The problem with Huawei is that, setting aside the accusations of, like, its security risks here in the U.S., like, mm-hmm, they've, you know, come under fire during the Trump administration and were banned, and that's the whole reason they don't have access to Google Apps or the Google App Store or Android anymore. There's also the fact that there's a lot of reports on how Huawei is working with or somehow facilitating the Chinese government, mm-hmm, on its really awful treatment of, and I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, Uyghurs, which is sort of like a Muslim community, yeah, in, I want to say, northern China. Yeah. The way I understand it, my understanding of this issue, by the way, comes from what I've known growing up, mm-hmm, and watching a lot of Chinese TV. And Chinese TV shows, especially the period dramas, villainize or vilify the what we call Xinjiang, which is that part where the Uyghurs are, more Muslim-based, mm-hmm, community.
I mean, that
apparently
even,
what happened.
I think even, yeah, the last Mulan movie kind of did that too. Like,
yes,
the bad,
exactly,
guys were the browner Chinese people. Ooh,
yes,
imagine,
yes,
that.
Exactly. For the longest time, I also just assumed they were Mongolian because, sure, that's what the subtitles were sometimes too, because we didn't really subtitle well in the past. So I made that association in my head. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, that's my understanding is obviously a little...
True.
The perspective that I have is a bit different, right? I feel, yeah, like to me, this has been a long and ongoing issue since way back,
for sure,
in the dynasties.
But the concentration camps are new. So, you know, the alleged concentration camps. Yeah. There's a lot of coverage of that. Be sure to read up on that, all that. We wrote about... there was a report that Huawei tested its facial recognition software that specifically targeted Uyghur Muslims in China. So that is... Mm-hmm. It's awful. It's bad, mm-hmm, stuff, and, mm-hmm, I think a lot of that is why we are not reviewing Huawei hardware. You know, we're not like covering them in the same way we'd cover other companies because we have to wait and see what's going on. Yeah,
yeah, and I'll say this: sometimes if you look at Engadget and you feel like, hey, there's something you might not be covering, often there will be a reason.
Yep.
One of them being questionable practices like this. And again, to be clear, Huawei might not actively be the people that are putting Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps. That's the Chinese government.
Yeah.
But its role here...
It's tech.
Like, it's something, yeah, we don't want to recommend to people.
It's
like, if they
like,
make products, we're not going to recommend.
Kind of like the IBM situation, too, right? Which IBM corporate would love to make everybody forget that its database software was used by Nazis to catalog Jewish people. And that is in the history of IBM. A lot of companies, you know, in the U.S. rushed to do business with Nazi Germany. And a lot of that's just swept under the rug, you know. So this almost seems like a similar situation. Yeah.
Yeah. And you'll also notice that we don't review / recommend Blink cameras, Amazon's, I believe, Blink cameras, because of the whole data and the sharing your streams to law enforcement.
That's
that
controversy. Ring cameras.
I think,
Ring cameras. Yeah.
My bad. Ring, I think it was, yeah, I think there was another site that called out a few other publications for still recommending Ring,
yep,
cameras. And I was so happy that Engadget did not make that list we made that decision a while ago.
We don't cover cameras very much either. But hey, even that's like a personal decision. You know, when I move to a house, you know, outside of New York City, I need a security system. Ring is still a thing that's recommended for like in-home use because it's just a security system, right? It is currently the best available offering. It is not like spewing data out and surveilling my neighborhood or anything. So I actually opted for a whole different camera setup. I'll be writing this up eventually. I'm using Arlo, which is Netgear's old camera thing.
Yeah.
But I have those like around my house now and a doorbell, and they're not sharing data with the police, and I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a bit more control over that.
Yeah, if we get into smart cameras, there's a lot of different options. I mean, I personally have used a Canary. I have mm-hmm. Nest. And yeah, there's plenty of brands out there like Netgear, and in addition to Amazon's Ring. Now, I will say that like Ring does offer some new privacy controls now, but until we can like get a definitive yes or no, I think you'll see that we try to make the best like decisions when it comes to our coverage. We got to be a bit responsible, right? So
the thing about Ring, by the way, is that you are automatically a part of the Ring neighborhood app, which is the thing where all captured footage is shared with other people or could be shared to Ring and accessed by the cop. So that's the whole thing. Yeah, it's not great. I don't like that.
Yeah, so anyway, that's our stance on Huawei. We haven't made similar decisions around Xiaomi, even though Xiaomi apparently also comes under fire for reported security issues. Yep. But know that we can continue to evaluate these situations and then make decisions when we have enough information, I think. So,
for sure.
We got some other news. This is like a news-heavy week, Devendra, right? Jeez.
So much news. Well, Spotify had a media event, and I know several of our reporters hopped on to mm-hmm. cover it because there was a lot of stuff coming out. They confirmed that hi-fi audio, so CD quality audio, is going to be coming later this year.
Nice.
In select markets. We don't know what the pricing is, but that would basically bring them in line with Tidal, I believe Amazon Music, and a bunch of other services that do like high-res
lossless sort of
streaming. Lossless, I assume, or at least like higher fidelity. And you know, it's a thing where right now Spotify, the highest quality setting is 320 kilobits per second MP3, mm. which I think to most people and most speakers and everything and headphones, that's gonna sound fantastic. Mm. The CD quality version is gonna be for the audiophiles who just, you know, they're the kind of people who keep their CDs around, mm-hmm. People who prefer the sound of physical media to streaming. If you can actually hear that, if you have $10,000 speakers, then it will probably make a difference. So that's a good thing. I just don't know how universal this feature is going to be. You know,
yeah, I was going to say
somebody who
my
cares
speakers.
A lot about audio quality.
Yeah, I was going to ask if my speakers would make a difference. Like, it would make a difference on my speakers, which are Ness Audio, which are pretty fine. But
it depends on how expensive your stuff is, right? If you have
not
$1,000 headphones, if you have speakers that cost $5,000 or more. Maybe you'll hear something, but even then you have to be in a quiet environment. You have to like sit there and really focus and listen. So high-res audio is not like day-to-day audio, mm-hmm. right? Like if you're commuting or walking around the neighborhood or something, you're probably not going to really hear the benefits of that yeah. stuff. So it's cool it's coming. It seems like a little late because I think there were reports since 2017 that Spotify was exploring this. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how they do it. Also, because bandwidth is an issue, too. Those mm-hmm. are much bigger files. Spotify, when Spotify launched, I talked with some folks like who used to work on the architecture of it. And there's like a bit of BitTorrent action going on to help like Spotify spread out data. I don't know if that's still happening. But the initial Spotify architecture was
like
there was a bit of data sharing going on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Between mm-hmm. the app. I don't know if that's still happening, but it'll be interesting to see how they deal with that. As people get 5G and things like that, you'll have access to bigger files, you know, on the go. So that's nice. Another major thing they announced is the most dad podcast sound ever,
yes.
like Dadcast, Obama cross Bruce Springsteen
yes.
podcast, where they just sit around and, talk about being cool dudes. And
I love
you sit and you, you sit and you put your leg over each other and you just stare at each other.
That's perfect.
As like boomer dads. It's pretty great. It's going to be the second show produced from the Higher Ground production company that the Obamas own. This series is going to be called Renegades Born in the USA. Great title. Come on.
Of course.
It's going to be an 8-episode show talking about race, fatherhood, marriage, and the future of America. So that's a thing. It's kind of fun. I believe, wasn't there a clip going around? I think one of the first things that went viral from this was that Obama was talking about how he punched a guy in the face who called him a racial slur. So you're going to learn
okay.
all sorts of stuff from
nice.
Our former president. Yeah.
Nice.
And everyone's like, yeah, good on you.
Yeah, I'm here for it.
Sure. are you going to be listening to this, Sherlyn? Do you care about Bruce Springsteen? You live in New Jersey.
Exactly. So I live in Jersey. I feel like I have
legally
to.
Required to.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say I might be, they might take back my driver's license, or my undriver's license.
Your undriver's license, yeah.
Yeah, but that story about Obama punching someone out, yeah, I'm here to listen to it. I want to find out more.
It's kind of cool. It does make me wonder, because I think about like the state of the podcast market and everything, and when it's just all these big names, you know, it's like when
every
major
celebrity
comedians come in, every celebrity has one. It's like easy money because you can get ads pretty easily. Mm-hmm. Or companies like Spotify is paying for this, you know, so they're paying Obama and Bruce Springsteen to make a podcast that all the dads everywhere will be listening to. It does make life harder for, I think, independent podcast producers, people like us who are like, let's talk about the news. Let's try to make a episode people will care about. It is tough. Damn these famous people.
Trust me. I have so many podcast ideas that are sort of in the works / sort of being talked about, and they're not, they're just not going to, because I'm like considering the saturation of the market, the staggering odds we're working against. I'm like, nobody's gonna listen to my podcast. So, and by this I mean my offshoot Sherlyn's show, whatever, not the Engadget
Sherlyn
podcast.
Thoughts.
The lowdown, the download. But the tea. But you know, I even have at least a few more, you know, followers than most people do. And I already feel
you're,
like the odds
you're a
are
minor
against
celebrity.
Me. I'm not. I don't even like that word. I'm not. I'm barely even known. But imagine if you're regular Joe or regular Jane, or you know, and you want to start your own podcast. It feels like it's so easy to do. But actually, think about all the celebrities that people
the
have celebrities, built in followings for.
They've ruined it. They've ruined podcasting. I don't know. So yeah, it is very easy to produce your shows. There are actually services now that are make it easier than ever. Recording shows together, editing online, it's all a thing with something like Zencastr, but discovery is a problem. So actually, to wit, because of that, Spotify says it's also going to be building machine learning tools to help people discover new podcasts. So that's kind of, I think that's pretty cool. Because right now, the other big problem is discovery, where there are a ton of good shows, and iTunes and other podcasters will like highlight the hottest things or the things everybody's downloading, but there's so much stuff out there. You need a smart way to like detail. What do you like? What do you like to listen to? What can it recommend to you? So it sounds like they're taking their current music engine, like the stuff that they're already doing to recommend music to people. They're kind of going to do that for podcasts too. So yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. I like to see how that works out, because I already get a lot of podcast recommendations on Spotify, and it's basically the podcast of all our rival publications. So
how
you
dare
listen
you
to the
Engadget
podcast.
You need a how dare you button.
Here's all the other people that you might want to listen. I'm like, no, I'm not going to listen to
my Here are all your mortal enemies. Please listen. Please listen. Let's talk about dying things because of the pandemic. Easy segue into Fry's Electronics, the renowned, the infamous West Coast electronics store. I have never been to one, but it's a giant store that was kind of famous for having like themed outlets, like different ones. Like there's one with like a UFO crashed into it. Huge stores that kind of sold everything, but also sold a lot of like specific geeky tech. Seems like a Radio Shack crossed with a Best Buy. They never really made it to the East Coast, so I never got to go to a Fry's. I could only see the ads online, and that makes me sad. They kind of unceremoniously just closed all the stores this week. They didn't put out a big announcement or anything. There was rumors going around on the internet, on Instagram and Twitter, where people noticed, like, this store is empty. And they went in to get something, and people were like, yeah, we're going to shut down the website later tonight, or at least, you know, close everything that's still open. So RIP Fry's. I don't know if you have any thoughts, Sherlyn. Did you have, like, good geeky stores in Singapore that actually sold hardware?
The reason I laugh is because there's apparently a few Singaporeans that watch our podcast. And every time I mention going to Singapore to buy something from an electronic store, they always shout out the same few names. We have like some malls known for, and it's called Sim Lim Square or Funan the IT Mall. And they're not themed so much as they're just the two spots. Apparently, you can just go and get really good electronics for fairly cheap compared to like big box stores.
All those electronics aren't being made far away from Singapore, right? So you guys have easy access to them. When we went to my first trip to Computex, so that would be my first trip to Taipei, I went to one of the tech malls there. Taipei has several tech malls. So check out that story in Gadget because there's a lot of photos. And it's really cool to have like just walk through a mall and have one store all owned by Asus ROG or one store all with Razer. You know, and you can go in there and play with the hardware. I found some really cool tchotchkes and cute battery packs for my wife. Yeah.
And some like weird stuff. Let's be honest. Some of the stuff I've seen in those malls are weird enough that I need like a NC-16 warning to talk about them here. So
it's very weird. And once you get into like the anime themed things, like things get a little dicey really quick. I also want to talk about something else that ended this week. CineFX Magazine, which is, if you go to a newsstand, if you ever went to like Borders or Barnes & Noble when those things were open and looked in their magazine section, there would always be this gorgeous color magazine with amazing photos on the front right next to Entertainment Weekly and all the other film stuff. And that's CineFX. It was all about the visual effects industry. It's been around for 40 years, detailing like the magic of movie making, you know, how people actually created special effects. And they did it for both practical and digital effects. They also announced this week that this latest episode, the one featuring the Mandalorian and the Child, is going to be their last because the pandemic made it very difficult for them to keep running a print magazine. Honestly, I'm shocked that they were able to keep it going for so long.
Yeah,
advertising like disappeared for them. Stuff to cover disappeared because it was harder to get access to companies and people weren't producing as many TV shows and movies. So I just want to point this out. I wrote up a post in Gadget called Farewell CineFX. You unlock the magic of VFX for everyone with some, you know, notes from people in the industry. ILM, I think, was the first one to announce this news on Twitter. Corey Barlog, the director of the God of War series, said, you know, it was the thing that helped him see the world of VFX in the Midwest. Who else? Also, somebody I know, John Lepore, from the VFX studio Perception in New York City, gave us some good quotes about, you know, what it was like finding CineFX for the first time, the influence it had on him. And, you know, this magazine's kind of led to his work, his life in VFX. And that's something we also cover in Gadget too. So check out our feature on Perception. I'm really sad because I like physical magazines. I like big glossy magazines. There really weren't that many devoted to movies, and especially like this is a geeky magazine. Like they have pages and pages of interviews, really in-depth articles, really technical stuff, which I think the Engadget audience will appreciate. So I had pinged them to see if they can survive digitally in the future because they did have an iPad edition, but the bulk of their like work was about this print copy. So I hope it comes back somehow because there's still room for in-depth technical coverage of movie making on the internet and in general, and it's sad that this thing is going. It was a beautiful thing. I have some old copies sitting around somewhere. It's so sad. Did you ever see this magazine, Sherlyn?
Not this one, but I remember when I used to work at Laptop Magazine, and I had joined right after they decided that would the last edition they made would be the last physical copy, and that was a real
bummer. Because of you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It was my fault, really. I brought the jinx. But it was like definitely like an era that's past us, right? Like I think there's people that are living today that don't know what a physical magazine really feels like.
No, I think the kids know
it. Like, they know what it is, but have they when the excitement of that hitting your mail, like your physical postbox, or for me it got the Newsweek magazines in schools, that sort of thing.
The exclusivity, of only getting information from these magazines, that is certainly gone because everything's on the internet. But I love new magazines. I love gaming magazines. I love smelling a new magazine. Guess what, though? With, like, that
you
smell?
Know,
yeah.
You know what? Uh-huh. Physical magazines are still thriving. These entertainment, celebrity gossip rags—they're still around, sure. And I still feel like we could save a few trees, but we'll see. Anyway,
we could save a few trees and brain cells and whatnot by reducing coverage of that. Oh, well, farewell, Cinefex magazine. If you see any floating around, I'd recommend you pick one up. It's $15, but you get some really good info. And if you like The Mandalorian, that latest issue will certainly be a good thing to have.
All right, so before we get to what Devendra and I have been working on, I wanted to shout out a few things that other Engadget team members have done this week, starting with Andrew Tarantola, who we affectionately call Andy. He recently published an article called What's Going On at Google AI? And I think this is a story that has been unfolding for a long time now, ever since a former Google's AI ethicist, Timnit Gebru, mm-hmm. I hope I'm pronouncing it right, tweeted in December about a very iffy resignation/termination that happened at Google. So basically their tweet was, quote, apparently my manager's manager sent an email to my direct report saying that she accepted my resignation. I hadn't resigned. I had asked for simple conditions first and said I would respond when I'm back from vacation, but I guess she decided for me. So it's not cool. That happened in December and things have been going on since. I mean, Google
didn't
have...
It's just been snowballing and escalating, right? Like, it's only gotten worse. And Google is not doing anything to kind of make it better. Yeah.
There's not a very good answer for what happened. So for everyone listening and watching and wanting to know what's going on here, Andy's article is a very good way to get caught up. Mm-hmm. Not to give away his whole story, but just to kind of give you some background. AI and ethics. That's a huge thing. There have been AI...
Google's like, I don't know what to do with this. Fire them. That's right. That's fine.
But we take it even further back. We zoom out even more, right? Like, there have been ethical boards or associations to look at the ethics of AI for years now, since really AI started getting thrown around as a buzzword. And my cousin is like a lawyer in Singapore. He recently published a report about criminal law and AI. Like, there's governments. He's doing that for the Singapore Academy of Law. And like, there's governments actually looking at the ethics of letting AI run our lives too, right? When AI commits a crime in a self-driving car, it hits someone, who's to blame? That sort of question needs to be asked. And there's a lot of ethics there. Google also had their own ethics department and group when it came to their AI. So Timnit Gebru, I think, was involved or actually, I believe, was leading the ethics AI part. One of the leaders, along with Margaret Mitchell, who is a computer scientist who specialized in algorithmic bias. And they both flagged issues that said some of these AI and some of these algorithms, they're just not good for minority groups. They're harmful, actively harmful.
Specifically, like, they were the ones that did the study that facial recognition does not recognize people with darker skin tones very well. And that is inherently racist. And I feel like one thing people talk about, especially in the tech community, is like, oh yeah, AI, the cool thing about AI is it's completely neutral. There's no bias or anything involved.
It's not.
Somebody has to program the AI. That initial data comes from somewhere and train it. So yeah, that initial info comes from somewhere. They did a good job of highlighting the kind of flaws in what Google was doing. Yeah. But wasn't the issue like, basically had a paper, right? That was going to say like a specific thing Google was doing is inherently bad and they shouldn't do it. It seemed like Google didn't like that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Again, you can get all the details from the article, but to answer what Devendra said, yes, Gebru's dismissal, it happened in December after she co-authored a research paper talking about Google's trillion parameter AI language model that is designed to mimic language. And she and her team argued that it could harm minority groups, saying that they don't believe enough thought has been put into the potential risks associated with developing these and that there's not been enough strategies to mitigate these risks, which are very fair questions to ask in an early stage research paper. And to be clear, that research that her and Margaret Mitchell did about darker skin tones being not recognized by AI led to some, I believe, led to some improvements, if not directly, then indirectly, right? About how our camera algorithms expose for darker skin tones. That sort of thing that Google has since highlighted. Now, I mean, I won't say they're effective, but Google itself, when it launched Meet hardware last year, said, we're working on improving camera algorithms to better recognize faces of people with darker skin tones. Yep. They acknowledge that. So,
something's happening. I mean, there's still reports right now, like kids in schools who need to take virtually proctored tests. One thing those software programs typically do is like uses a camera to make sure you are you and it recognizes you and you're sitting there and you're not like looking at your phone or something. A lot of students are saying like they really have to crank up all the lights in their room and like put a spotlight on themselves to make the software know they're actually there. So these are important questions. The weird thing is that Google basically objected to her doing that initial paper about the AI language model and just completely dismissed it. And first they asked her to completely, you know, take herself out of that paper, I believe, like just not be a part of this. She refused. The conversation with her was like, can we talk about this somehow? And then that's when they had fired her during her vacation. People came to her defense. So other folks on her team and Google, what was it? Mitchell, her co-
Margaret Mitchell, her colleague
in the ethics AI group, Margaret Mitchell was locked out of her account after she started speaking out too. And like, it's a lot of weird things. And then most recently Google announced like they're reorganizing the whole ethics, the ethical AI team. Except they didn't tell the ethical AI team.
Yeah.
So never feels good to be moved around in ways you don't know. Yeah.
So, I mean, sort of tying back to our earlier conversation on how Engadget sometimes covers things, right? Yep. I think that each little piece of this developing saga story is not something that we would hit piecemeal. We wouldn't hit each little development. I don't know that we would. I'm not sure. But
it depends.
It depends on the situation.
I think the initial story is something we should have hit. I forget if we actually were there at the beginning.
May or may not have. I'm not sure. But we often also have to wait till we can get the facts confirmed. And then so sometimes it just makes more sense to do a longer story like this that can get all of the facts and the story and the timeline right. And so I think if you want, again, to catch up on what happened here, go check out Engadget.com. The title or the headline for the story is What's Going On at Google AI.
It's a good primer. Yeah.
It's a very good primer. So another thing that was published this week was Nicole Lee's review of the Amazon Echo Show 10. One of the reasons I bring it up is because it's one of our few like big product reviews this week. And it is an interesting device. This is basically a smart display with a rotating, like a swiveling base so that it will keep...
The screen moves around, right?
Right, to face you whenever you talk to it. So it doesn't matter where you are related to the device itself, the screen will always face you. Which can be good, like if you have your smart display situated in like a kitchen on a kitchen island and you're just like constantly walking around talking to it.
Sure.
Could be very useful. Except for this is a $250 smart display, compared to Amazon's other smart display, the Echo Show 8, which has very similar features but is smaller and doesn't rotate, and it only costs $130. So almost twice the price.
They've pushed the cost down of these screens quite a bit. I think the Echo Show 10 used to sell for like $200 when it initially came out. But even then, $250 for a screen like this, like that's not that much.
It's not
like,
that expensive.
The tech involved here.
Yeah, especially when you consider that others in the space, let's say the Nest Hub Max, are what, $399 or $3 and upwards. So I understand. That's still like Amazon's thing is still like more affordable than the competition. But basically Nicole's review makes it pretty clear like why or what are you getting and you know who would be the right person to buy this sort of a device. And to be clear, $250 is still a good price. So my personal takeaway is that like if you're more in the Amazon ecosystem than you are anything else, this is probably more for you. And if you're in the Google ecosystem, then a Google smart display is probably more for you.
Well, also, like, I think the question of surveillance is, like, the big thing here, too. Like, that is always the trouble with the Echo and the Show devices, anything with Alexa, but now this is one that can literally just follow you around the room, so you can't even like hide from it in certain ways. So, you know, it's up to you if you buy this. You kind of know what you're getting into if you buy something like this. But Amazon owns Ring, and one of our issues with Ring that we were talking about was those like surveillance and privacy issues as well. I own Echo devices. Like, I actually own the Echo Studio. I bought it last year. That's a $200 speaker that has some really good tech in there. So compared to something like the HomePod, you know, like I would rather invest in that. But I am also aware of the privacy concerns. Any of these speakers are tough. Would you buy this, Sherlyn?
No, because I only really have one or two smart displays. Both are Google, just because I like having my Google Photos display easily. And I'm more in the Google ecosystem. Like, I have a Chromecast, Google TV, that sort of thing. It just all works more seamlessly.
You have the G tattooed on your arm. Like, I get it. You love Google.
G? Oh, G, yeah.
The G.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. The big G. But that's what some of the other teammates at Engadget have been working on. Devendra, what about you? What have you been working on?
I'm still working on the review for the MSI GS66 I've been talking about. It's taken a while because video has been tough. I sent it to our video producer, Brian O, and he couldn't get the game stuff working or the game capture. So we're going to have a video of that soon, but the actual review will be up later this week. I think it's notable for being one of the first 1440p gaming laptops we've seen. It has RTX 3080 in it. It's a cool laptop, but there are some issues. The fans are super, super loud. So my review's a little mixed on it. I'm also planning for Microsoft Ignite, which is a pretty... It's more of like an industry-focused conference from them. That's where we learn more about what's coming next in Office and other things like their mixed reality stuff. So we're going to be talking about a lot of that stuff for next week. But yeah, Sherlyn, what is up with you?
So this week has been mostly like, you know, hitting the news that keep coming, and my ThinkPad X1 Nano review finally went up, so you can go check it out. Long story short, it's a very light ThinkPad. there you go. And I'm also getting in some pretty quirky products and devices. Those of you who enjoyed the mask phone little hands-on that I did a while back will enjoy what I've got coming up for you. But these are definitely under embargo. Well, some of them are under embargo, and I shall not say. I would like to surprise y'all, but come back next week. There will be fun stuff to see. And then some other stuff I still can't talk about. So there we go. Lots of secrets.
Let's move on to our pop culture picks. Sherlyn, what do you have in store for us this week?
So this week, I blame Valentina, our commerce editor, for the YouTube hole I found myself in. All of this week, most of this week, I found myself catching up on YouTube tea, YouTube drama. And I used to pay attention to beauty YouTube. So it would be like the whole Tati Westbrook, James Charles, and Jeffree Star and Shane Dawson controversy.
I'm nodding. But yes, I know these names. Okay.
You know this? Very good. No. I'm glad.
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. I was surprised.
Say more.
Didn't want to judge. But the way I managed to catch up with some of this stuff is through a YouTuber called D'Angelo Wallace. D'Angelo Wallace is a commentary YouTuber, and he is just really cogent and so thoughtful about the videos he's put together. He has two styles of videos. One are these 10-minute explainer style videos. And really the very first video of his I watched that Valentina introduced me to was his 10-minute sort of explainer of the Hilaria Baldwin incident.
Yes, okay.
AKA the Hilaria Baldwin incident.
You need to explain what that incident is, because I think it is one of the wildest stories of insane celebrity culture I've seen ever. Yeah?
Totally. So Hilaria Baldwin or Hilaria Baldwin. I don't even. Hilaria. We're just going to say Hilaria from here on. Hilaria Baldwin, originally Hillary Thomas, is most well known for being wife of Alec Baldwin. Sure. And yet there somehow she was born in Boston, grew up there more or less, but somehow decided halfway through that I love Spain. I'm going to say I'm born in Mallorca, Spain. And
her family spends a lot of time in Spain, so that is her connection there.
That's what she says. But then you will see multiple video clips of her saying she has 35 to 40 family members from Spain, and she grew up in Spain, and then she backpedaled and said she was spent a lot of time in Spain. She went from saying her parents lived in Spain to visit Spain. And because the internet did what it did best, which is to debunk every one of those things. So anyway, if you want a good catch up on that little piece of internet drama, D'Angelo Wallace's video is actually really good.
Very cool. The drama is that she pretended she was somebody with a Spanish accent in a way that helped her sell her crappy food recipes and stuff better. Like, it is, talk about appropriation.
As an immigrant, it hurt me to see this, because as an immigrant who struggles with her own accent, to see someone adopt an accent and that people who usually try to hide, it was very insulting. And she basically sometimes adopts a more Spanish sounding accent and forgets English words for common food items like cucumbers.
That she knows as a girl from Boston. Boston area. Yeah.
Also, cucumber is a very common vegetable. It's not like me and Valentina were talking about this. We're like, it's not like it's an eggplant where there's three different words in three different languages.
What's that word? Cucumber.
Cucumber. Oh, there's no different word cucumber. In a different language. Anyway. But D'Angelo Wallace breaks it down. D'Angelo Wallace also, that's one style, the 10-minute video. He also had a 10-minute video on Soho Karen. Y'all should catch up on that, too. Soho Karen is the girl who lost her phone, thought it was a black boy in a hotel in Soho, New York, and tackled him. But actually, she had left it in an Uber.
Imagine that.
But the videos that I did get sucked into were the James Charles, the beauty YouTube community drama from last year and the year before that, maybe. He did hour-long videos kind of explaining why each of these personalities is flawed and unearths some really good information and presents very convincing cases. D'Angelo Wallace himself won a Streamy fairly recently for being one of the best commentary YouTubers, or actually was nominated for a Streamy, my bad. But just his videos are so well produced, so high quality, so well researched, and just put together. You can see so much time and effort went into them. The animations are great. The editing is great. His commentary is great. So I respect the hell out of this person. So that's my pick. The other thing I did watch this week was the this Netflix docu-series called Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. Did you see that one?
Oh, boy. This is a story I've known about for a while, so to have a whole series devoted to this creepy hotel. This was the one where they found a girl who was in the water tower, and she was there for a while, and people were drinking the water.
17 days. So this is about the disappearance of Elisa Lam, the case at least that we were talking about. And I was very drawn to it, A, because she's an Asian girl and I'm an Asian girl. And I was like, oh, no, I could end up in the water tank. But B, the series, though, focuses on this hotel and all of the things that have happened there. Richard Ramirez stayed there while he was the Night Stalker. I think that was his criminal name. It could be something else.
Is he the Night? I forget who. Yeah, which one?
He could be the Night Stalker or the one of the many other criminal names. Anyway, Richard Ramirez stayed there during his tenure as a killer, as a serial killer. There have been multiple suicides. It's just a very troubled hotel with a strange history. The Elise Lam.
This is one
case.
In downtown LA, right? Which is it's a. There's some weird stuff there because it's a hip area at certain times, but also it's Skid Row. And it's also you can clearly see the dichotomy between very rich LA and very poor LA. Yeah. And this hotel is just situated amidst all of that. I had some friends who I think tried to stay there for E3 or something one year, and they were like, I don't want to be in this building. We got to go somewhere else. So it's like, it is one of those like heavy places where a lot of crap has gone down, apparently. Uh-huh. Yikes. Yeah. Yeah. Web sleuth, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've seen a bunch of this, by the way, and I like the, they do focus on like the mental health aspect, where I think part of it was the person who was in the water tower, like she was bipolar, she had issues, and maybe there was a certain responsibility from the hotel to take care of her in a way, like just at least acknowledge the fact that she is going through something. And it seems like the hotel just didn't. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on here.
This was an intriguing case. It was a very interesting case. But it does try to hit a lot of things. Maybe too much, but it's engaging.
Okay. I wanted to bring up a movie I saw on Hulu. Something I've been looking forward to for a long time. And I think you'd really like it too, Sherlyn. It's by Chloe Zhao, who is a Chinese-American director. She did The Writer a couple of years ago. And this is a movie called Nomadland. It's about a woman played by Frances McDormand who loses everything after the Great Recession. Her husband passes away. She doesn't really have a job. She gives everything up. She kind of sells whatever she does have to buy a van and live out of that van. It's about the community of people in America who choose to live like nomads, to travel around the country, to live in their either vans or RVs or whatever they have, gather at campgrounds, kind of form their own community of people who it seems like society has kind of let down in a way. And it's a tremendous movie. I love this movie a lot because it does really focus on something I'd say is like the ultimate failure of America, right? Like I think the immigrant story, you know, the story my parents believed when they came to this country was like, yeah, America's a land of possibilities, a land of success. You work hard, you could get whatever, you know, whatever you deserve here. But Nomadland is like the story of people who did a lot of that work, you know, people who worked at company towns, they, you know, devote themselves to a single company. And the thing with the story is that she, her character, Fern, worked and lived at a place that was basically a company town. When the company went bankrupt, the town just disappeared. You know, the town's just gone because there's nothing else to support it. So it wasn't like even like a legitimate or like a city built up by a civil government or something. So she has no money. She has to go to Amazon, shipping factories to kind of get some work. She gets work doing all sorts of things. It is about the struggle that a lot of people are facing in America, especially if you're older, you don't have retirement savings, and the pressure of living a life in America is like, well, you got to have a house, you got to have, a decent job, you have to have stuff. And this is a movie that's all about like what happens when you give up on that stuff in a way and kind of break free from the constraints of society. So it is it's a feature, it's a narrative feature, but it's also like semi-documentary because Chloe Zhao brings in people from this nomad community who talk about their own lives and their own experiences and like add a layer of authenticity to the movie. So yeah, it's a beautiful film. I highly recommend checking it out. Also check out The Writer, which is a movie she did about a Native American rodeo rider who is coming to terms with the fact that if he could ride or not. And that was played by non-actors, amateurs, but people who lived in that community. I love her movies because there's always like it's all about realism and authenticity, almost semi-documentary like, but also with a narrative that she wraps around it. Chloe Zhao like is on a roll right now because she is actually working on a Marvel movie. She's doing Immortals, which is the one what's his face got beefed up for from Silicon Valley.
Oh, Silicon Valley. I know who you're talking about. Ah, I know exactly who you're
Kumail,
talking about.
Kumail Nanjiani. I'm trying to think like which Indian comedian is he? Which is the other thing. The Kumail, who I love, I think is great, but he got super beefed up for this movie. I do wonder how, like, her sensibilities as, like, an artist, as somebody who creates these, like, really realistic dramas, is going to adapt to Immortals, you know, or, like, a Marvel Cinematic Universe thing. It'll be really interesting, but I think you should check it out also because, you know, shout out to somebody, an immigrant into this country, who is telling stories about America in ways I think few American directors actually are. She has such a great lens into this country. So I'd highly recommend Nomadland. It's on Hulu right now.
I want to really quickly correct what we said. Kumail Nanjiani. There's three syllables to that name. And that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, and I talk about movies and TV at the /filmcast at /film.com.
If you want to send me tips about the hottest tea around YouTube, you can hit me up on Twitter at Sherlyn Lope. Email us your thoughts and feedback at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.